Hello, Christian. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Hey, Shane. Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate the invitation and the opportunity.
Yeah, I'm really excited about our conversation today. You're an author, a speaker, spiritual coach, transformation coach. I mean, the list is kind of endless, and it's fantastic. And you've recently come out with a new book, right? It's called Awakening the Soul of Power, and it's really it's a fantastic book. I've got it and I've read it, and I would highly recommend it to people. And I'm excited to talk to you about some of the cool ideas in that book today.
Thank you. You know, that means a lot. Writing, I'm not one of these writers for whom writing is fun and I get lost in it. For me, it's work. So I really, for me, it's like a means to an end. It's a means to get a message out, a message of that's going to help people transform their lives and get free. So that you're saying that means a lot.
No, it's wonderful. And I think that the messages are really deep and profound, and it's clear that it comes from a good place, and that, you know, your intention with it is to help people and to really give or show people a way to, you know, as you say, be a hero, and whatever that hero is for you, and to recognize, you know, what's true in your life and the places where, you know, your ego is kind of getting a bit in the way, and how you can ultimately find peace and happiness and fulfillment in the world. And so it's really fantastic. And so, thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
So perhaps we can sort of just start off with a bit of an idea of what your conception of a hero is. What does that mean to be a hero for people?
Yeah, and that's such a good question. You know, and I think, by the way, that's one of the ways in which COVID has served all of us, without minimizing the tragic aspects of it. But it's forced us to redefine and to expand what it means to be a hero. Like, before that, most of us would probably think of a, you know, superhero with a cape, or maybe a first responder, a firefighter, a warrior, somebody who puts their life at risk for the sake of somebody else or for a greater cause. Now we include our medical professionals, our doctors, our nurses, our respiratory therapists, you know, and even our grocery store clerks or delivery people who really put their lives at risk and made some huge sacrifices in terms of the time they spent with their families and the quality of their lives to keep the rest of us going and fed and provided for. So what about the rest of us, right? That's what the book questions and poses. And it poses a way of living that is nothing short of heroic. Like, to just go through life, you know, buffeted by the ups and downs and at the power of and at the effect of other people's judgments and expectations and demands and the culture. Anybody can do that. To react when somebody says something that we interpret as hurtful, anybody can do that. To project our own stuff onto somebody else, anybody can do that. To be stuck in victim mode, in a victim relationship to life, anybody can do that. Like, to pause, to go within, to choose, like to feel the sting of somebody's words or actions and pause and take a breath and ask ourselves, how do I want to respond? And to choose that. That's, to me, it's heroic. To develop a more empowered relationship with life. Because one thing that we can count on is that life is going to continue throwing curveballs our way. And so, I mean, that's just a fact. But what we can always choose is how we show up in response to those events and those circumstances. And just that minor shift, in my perspective, it changes everything and is nothing short of heroic. To reel back our expectations, to pop ourselves out of this victim mode, it's nothing less than heroic. And to forgive what sometimes feels unforgivable, it's nothing less than heroic. And the thing to remember is, like, it's almost cliche to say that forgiveness is for us. But here's a way that might be helpful for people to think, to hold it as, when, as long as we're holding somebody over the fire for what they did or failed to do, our hand is also getting burnt. So in that way, it really makes it clear that forgiveness is for us, and it has to do with our freedom, with our empowerment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a wonderful explanation of it, because, you know, when you're holding things against people, like, that's all happening inside your head, right? And perhaps sometimes that motivates action and, you know, you sort of do things, but a lot of the time you're just holding your hand over that fire with that, with whatever grievance you're holding on to. And so it causes you a lot of, you as in the, you know, yourself, a lot of suffering unnecessarily. I mean, you know, for me, the idea that you are not your thoughts or your emotions, those things are kind of just features of, you know, a human existence and the mind and the body, and that there is something that there's a lot deeper than that, that is the true source of power, right? Which is the source of power for the hero, is to be able to take that, to know that no matter what happens to you or in the world, like, it doesn't need to affect you and ruin your day and cause you immense suffering, right? Nothing is going to do that except how you interpret and judge things, and the way in which that affects you is really up to you, right? It's that responding versus reacting kind of mentality.
Exactly. And that alone, it's a game changer. It's as simple and as difficult as that. And to have the presence and the awareness to be able to navigate life in that way, to me, it's nothing short of heroic, because it requires that willingness to go within, to look at ourselves, to face our own inner demons, to ask ourselves hard questions. It's like, why did that hurt me? And what are the patterns? Why do I keep attracting a certain kind of person or a certain kind of relationship? Sometimes it feels like we're in the same boring play with the same boring movie, just with a different actor. So why do we do the things we do? And why do we get stuck in these ruts of behavior patterns that are often self-sabotaging? And all that work, that willingness to do that work, is heroic and so rewarding, because it makes possible personal freedom and personal empowerment. And you're absolutely right. It's about that ability to choose how we respond to any of the circumstances of life. I live in South Florida these days, in Miami. And, you know, for us, hurricanes are a fact of life. And the visual of the eye of the storm is a powerful one for us down here. And I think that's what you're pointing to, you know, that ability to go through life as the eye of the storm. Like, yeah, people are going to have their drama, stuff is going to happen, crap is going to happen that sometimes sucks, and we wish it weren't so, and dramatic events are going to happen in the world. And so how do we go through life observing, allowing all that stuff, because we're never going to control any of that. So we just allow it, and we just don't need to take it on. Like, we can choose how we respond to it, how we show up and respond.
Yeah, and you're right, because life will throw shit at you constantly. And, you know, there might be some periods of relative peace and, you know, sort of tranquility, but sooner or later, shit's going to hit the fan. And when it does, in whatever way it manifests for you as an individual, like, that's where the power comes from, right? Is to be able to not let the world determine your inner state of being, right? And to really see that whatever happens outside, that's mostly beyond your control, because, as you say, most things in life are far from within your control. It is a heroic kind of act, because it does take great courage to be able to do that. And, you know, one of the concepts in the book that I really thought was great was you coined this term, the egolem, right? which is the sort of amalgamation of the ego and the Gollum character from Lord of the Rings, which is the, you know, to symbolize the sort of shadowy or inauthentic, scared part of each of us, which, you know, is the ego, right? Which is the mind-made sense of self. And that entity tries to control the world, right? And it's really that thing that stops you from being happy and from being your own hero. And so for me, when I read it, it was like the heroic aspect of it is to have the courage to be able to look at that, right, and face those demons and be able to say, oh, this hurts to look at, right, because it does, but ultimately it's freedom, right? And so perhaps you could go into a little bit more detail, like how exactly does the ego, what do you mean by ego, and how does that manifest for people, and what do we do about it?
And that is a huge question. You know, I spent the whole third of the book, or maybe fourth of the book, speaking about that, because it's really important that we get it. There's a lot of confusion about that word ego. Most of us who know it will think arrogance or inflated sense of self. And it is that, for sure. But it's so much more than that. And then maybe if we took Psych 101, we might think, you know, Freud's model of personality, the id, the ego, the superego. And there are aspects that apply, but the way that I talk and teach about the ego is more derived from Eastern teachings. And ego means I am in Latin. And so it's a sense of self. It's a sense of individual personality. And here's a great kind of image to help us get it. If you put a baseball in the center of a stadium, that's the ego. Who we are is actually the stadium. And we've allowed this tiny, tiny part of who we are to think that it is all of who we are, and to run our lives and to make really important, critical, consequential choices from a small, limited, and always fear-based perspective. So if we want to have our relationships to have a chance at working, if we want to have a sense of personal empowerment, if we want to have a life that is filled with meaning and purpose, it's critical to understand what the ego is, and it's self-made prison so that we can let ourselves out, because nobody else can do that. It's self-made. So that's why I spent, you know, the majority of the first part of the book talking about that. And I mean, there's so much more to say about that. The ego is a sense of self, the sense of individual personality. It's one of the things that sets us apart from other species. You know, we as far as we know, we're the only species that has a sense of self. Like, in fact, if we looked at our Latin name, Homo sapiens sapiens, one way that we can translate that is humans who know that we know. So the ego is that reflexive ability, that ability to reflect back upon ourselves. There's some theories about the dolphins and the whales and the elephants and the higher primates, and, you know, the greater apes, that indicate that they might have a sense of self. So for example, we've seen the YouTube videos where we put a dog or a cat in front of a mirror, and they interact with that image as if it was another dog or cat. They've done studies where they'll put ash on the shoulder of a chimp or a gorilla, place them in front of a mirror. At some point, they wipe it off, so indicating that they realize that image is them. But whether to jump from there to having an individual sense of personality, like this is Christian, that's Shane, we can't make that jump. So it's both a leap in evolution, like it's huge in terms of the evolution of consciousness, and it's also the source of all our suffering. Because once we have that sense of individual identity, now we can have loneliness, we can feel lonely, we can have abandonment issues, we have a sense of our own mortality, etc. So there is definitely a price to pay for that individual identity, which is what keeps us separate from each other and from all of creation.
Yeah, and that makes sense, right? And it's interesting how you see it in, as you're saying, in the animal kingdom, where in the world that we live in, right, things do appear to be separate, right? And we do tend to think of ourselves as separate from everything, when that's not quite exactly true, and it's just how you perceive it that becomes the problem, right? Like with it, with our sort of advanced, you know, I guess it's our sort of prefrontal cortex, where we can be aware of our thinking and we think of ourselves as separate entities. You're right, there's a huge price to pay for it, where you don't know then that you're connected to everything else. You lose that sense of connection that animals do have, even though, you know, they live their own existence and they do their own thing, and there's some sense of self-awareness in some of the, you know, higher primates, as you had said, and that's great, but they don't get lost in thoughts of problems and worries and loneliness, and, you know, I mean, they suffer. Suffering, or pain perhaps is a better word, is sort of a universal guarantee. I mean, even plants to a large degree, I mean, to a smaller degree, experience difficulty and challenge and drought and being eaten and all kinds of things, right? Like, yeah, there's no getting away from that. But they don't feel sorry for themselves. They're not constantly in these states of anxiety and depression and fear and sense of, like, purposelessness and hopelessness. Guilt. And yeah, and guilt and shame and trying to figure out the world and, you know, wondering what their place is and trying to... That's a, you know, uniquely human problem.
But yeah, and so since much you open the door to colorful language, they don't do the self-inflicted mindfuck.
No, that, they don't.
That, the number that we do on ourselves, which is all ego-based.
Yeah. I mean, for me, one of the most, I guess, profound, it's not really a moment, but like sort of lessons that I've learned in life was that, you know, thoughts aren't who I am. Right, they happen, it's more like they happen to me, just like, you know, it doesn't feel like that a lot of the time for some reason, but that deeper sense of like, oh, I don't have to take my thoughts seriously, they're just thoughts, right?
Right.
But if you do take them seriously, that's when all these problems start, because that's when your mind starts evaluating its value and whether it's good enough or not good enough, and, you know, what needs to be different, or how things should be better, or, you know, why other people or things are to blame, and all these kind of crazy evaluations about the world. Like, yeah. I mean, they might be true, but they might not, you know?
Yeah, and all the layers of meaning that we add to that, which is part of that number that we do in ourselves. The ego is always comparing itself. It's always feeling better than or worse than. And the tragic part of that is that we give our power away to people who have even less of a clue. So, you know, we get up in the morning and it's a beautiful day and we're singing along to our favorite soundtrack, and we get to the office or the bank or wherever we're going, and the nasty clerk at the front desk, so we're going to the bank, you know, asks us for our card. Our bank card, and says it to us in a nasty way, and all of a sudden we're like either outraged in indignation about how rude and how dare you treat me this way, I'm the customer and the customer's always right, and then all the stories that we add to that, or we plummet into failure. And so, oh my God, I can't believe I forgot my bank card again. I probably shouldn't be allowed to bank here. I probably shouldn't be even allowed to live on this planet. And we go, it's like the seesaw. We go from one end to the other all day long. And that's all ego-based. It's like, and the sad part is that we make all these conclusions about ourselves from misunderstandings of stuff that happened to us when we were so young, young minds that didn't know any better. And we heard something, or maybe we were told something in a moment of overwhelm and then the parents regretted it, or the teacher or whoever said it, but those little minds just take it on as truth. And then we spend the rest of our lives coming from that place of feeling not good enough, or there's something wrong with me, or I'm too much of this, not enough of that. And it's like, it's tragic because none of it is true. Like our inherent worth is that. It's inherent.
Yeah. And, you know, the stories that we tell ourselves about our sense of worth and whatever it is, like after those incidences, it can go on for hours or days, you know, over nothing. And, you know, as you said, like the other person who was part of the interaction could have very well have never even remembered that that happened, right?
Exactly.
It meant nothing to them. But to us, it's like, poof, you know, it's this huge catastrophe that we need to think about and tell other people about and, you know, try and figure out and, you know, evaluate whether what it means and all these like really crazy. I mean, it kind of is crazy. I mean, it's not to be sort of, you know, rude about it, but it is a crazy way of approaching the world. And I do the same thing. I'm not saying it's other people. Like, it's how we've just come into this world, right?
Yeah, it's the human condition. It's the ego is a state of consciousness. And so part of our job, part of what's our mission is to disidentify with the baseball or the football and begin to shift our thinking and our how we think of ourselves and our perspective and begin to identify as the stadium. Mm-hmm. Which has completely different set of rules and laws, even like different physics, and things happen that are beyond what the rational mind can understand, and then we attribute words like magic or miracles, and it's that we're living in this different reality, this different way of doing life that is accessible to every one of us. And it's just, it's who we are. It's our nature. But we've allowed this tiny, tiny, tiny part of us, part of our psyche, to think that it is all of who we are. And that's the tragic aspect of the human conditioning, of the human condition.
And it's unnecessary as well. I mean, you know, I guess from one perspective, like you used the word that like we allowed this to happen to ourselves. But I mean, I would sort of argue that like we don't even know that we're doing it, right? It's not a conscious decision in the sense of like the conscious that we're speaking of, where it's that higher order of consciousness, right? Where you make real free will decisions about things, right? They're choosing to respond in certain ways. But you're right. It's absolutely a manifestation of the human condition where this is just how it works and this is what you get. But there is this great movement that's happening in our time and has been happening for thousands of years to varying degrees, depending on the ages and, you know, different spiritual teachers and sages and things like that. I mean, the messages have been the same essentially throughout human history of like, listen, this doesn't have to be how you live your life, right? There's so much more to it if you're just prepared to take a step back and look within yourself to find out who you really are deep down, right? And the amazing thing is that when you do that, you kind of disappear a little bit, right? And the ego doesn't like that. You disappear in the sense of like, well, it doesn't, you don't really have to worry about, you know, reputation or wealth or success or any of that kind of thing, because none of that stuff really matters if you can connect with your deeper self, right, so to speak. And that's why I really like your messaging of it being a heroic journey, because it takes tremendous courage to be able to confront that part of yourself, knowing, or perhaps not even knowing, that it's going to end that part of you, right? That part of you will, to a large degree, go away or die, if you want to use that word. But it's actually, it's liberation, right? And it's freedom.
Yeah, and it's only an illusion of death. It's not real death. It's just that the death of, it's like, you know, there's some teachings that say you got to kill the ego, you got to get rid of it, because it's the source of all our suffering. And that part of it is true. It is the source of all our suffering. My understanding of it is that you know, that it's, that we don't need to kill it, that, and that as long as we're in a body, it's not a bad thing to have a sense of individual personality. There's a lot to be said for that. And there's some of the qualities and that become possible because of the ego that are good. It's great, you know, for strategizing and projecting and all that kind of stuff, projecting into the future. So my understanding what we're going for is it's healing the ego so that people can do whatever they do and we don't take it personally, we don't react. And also taking it out of its place, where it has placed itself, thinking that it is the sun. So what we're doing is like saying, hey, like, you know, like, I've got this, I'm making that choice. I'm not going to make that choice from your fearful, limited, paranoid perspective. And you go do what you do. Here's the project. Go do that. That's a good thing for you to do. And so we're placing the ego in its proper place in orbit around the sun, in service to the sun, rather than thinking that it is the sun. And you know, there's a lot to be said about that too. It's like, how do we know? Like the voice in our head, who's speaking? And just a couple of real simple ways that we can begin to get better at. Like the ego, I like to say, went to law school. So it's always using big words, big concepts, pulling from here, pulling from there. It's always building a case to prove that it's right. It's got a real need to be right. Whereas that other part of us, the voice of the stadium or the soul, the higher self, whatever you want to call it, that stadium nature, that has a much better perspective and is aware of our interconnectedness to all of it. That part of us, it's that still quiet voice inside that all the sacred texts tell us about. So the thing is, like, we've got to get underneath and beyond that crazy, what the Buddhists call the monkey mind, that's how they refer to the ego mind, because it jumps from thought to thought in the same way that a monkey goes from branch to branch, and it drives us crazy with something to say about everyone and everything every single moment of the day until we fall asleep exhausted, if we're able to fall asleep exhausted at the end of the day, because sometimes it keeps us going through the night with that self-inflicted mindfuck that we were talking about earlier. Mm. And so if we're able, like, once we learn how to go underneath that crazy, how to quiet it, the voice of the stadium, it's quiet and it's simple. And it uses words and messages like yes, no, like do that. I wouldn't go there. Like, when do we get into trouble? When we override that inner sense of intuition and we go there anyway. Every single time, that's when we get into trouble. And so those are just some of the ways that we can begin to, you know, I get into more of that in the book, but so some of the ways that we can begin to identify the voices in our heads.
Yeah. I was going to say, like, perhaps we can talk a little bit about how one might approach starting to, you know, recognize this voice in our head for what it is. And I think, you know, for you and for me as well, like, one of the most powerful tools is breath work, right? The meditation of becoming aware of breathing. Would you mind, like, explaining that a little bit?
Well, you know, the way that we begin to identify those voices in our head is for understanding, like understanding conceptually what the ego is and how it behaves. So its need to be right. It's going back and forth between superiority or inferiority. It's defensiveness, it's reactivity. It's being stuck in victim mode in relationship to others and to life. It's judgment, it's expectations, it's demands of others. Et cetera, and all the ways, you know, like that all the way that the ego behaves. So it's really important to understand it so that we can spot it in ourselves and then start getting the understanding the patterns. Because if we look at our relationships, there's one common denominator in every one of those situations and every one of those relationships. So at some point we have to get honest and ask ourselves, why do I keep finding myself in these situations? And why do I keep attracting a certain kind of person or a certain kind of relationship? And it's heroic to go within and to ask ourselves and to see those patterns. A lot of the work too is about becoming aware, you know, so that we can notice what we do with things we do. And one of the best practices, and Carl Jung, the psychologist, said that the process of enlightenment is making the subconscious conscious. So rather than being driven by subconscious stuff and misunderstandings and traumas that we never resolved from early childhood, and that are still having an impact on our behavior and our relationships, and being willing to go within, again, it's heroic, and it begins with self-awareness. And one of the best tools for self-awareness and for healing all those past traumas is the breath. And you know, it's, again, that's a huge conversation. We could spend the whole time just talking about the breath, because there's a lot of different ways and practices that we can use the breath for different purposes. So there's breathing techniques to manage stress, to help us sleep better. There are other breathing techniques that are more energizing and then bring focus, that'll be great, like right before an important meeting or something like that. And then there are, you know, what are different modalities that tend to be called breath work, which is a longer practice. You breathe in a certain way, in a circular, connected way for about an hour and a half, and amazing, amazing stuff happens. I was on a track to get a PhD in psychology. My dad was a psychiatrist, so I come out of that psychotherapy tradition. When I discovered breath work, and meaning the longer healing practices, 30 years ago, it changed my life. Like after the one session, I knew that I'd never be the same, and I wasn't. I jumped tracks. I never went for the PhD, and I've been offering breath work ever since all over the world. And I've yet to come across anything that heals as quickly and as profoundly. And I'm talking serious stuff. I've worked with countless people who have, you know, who experience sexual abuse or other types of abuse, who survived like dramatic, violent stuff. And it gets healed. And like even 30 years later, when I hear these words coming out of my mouth, it's like, I know that sounds too good to be true to the more logical, more skeptical, more scientific part of my mind. That still sounds too good to be true, that all that can happen because just from breathing. And on top of that, it can heal at so many levels, not only emotionally and psychologically in terms of past trauma, but it heals spiritually and even physically. And yes, I know that sounds too good to be true, but I can't argue with results. It works with permanent effects. And, you know, the science isn't there yet in terms of like understanding how it works. Like there's a lot of research on meditation and what's happening in the brain and the effects on our health and productivity, et cetera. The breath work isn't there yet. There are my ability to understand it is more from the psycho-spiritual perspective. And when we look at the fact that in most spiritual traditions and some secular languages even, one word, the same word, can mean either spirit or breath, depending on context, depending on what we're talking about. That's what helps me to begin to understand how it can be so powerful and how it can create and provide for us some of the amazing spiritual, for lack of another word, experiences that I often have people tell me, I got to the same place that I got to in a sacred plant medicine experience, to that experience of oneness, of interconnectedness, experiences of the reality of the stadium, that we can access those places just by using the breath, and that it can heal with such permanent effects. It still boggles my little mind. And yet, it's like, I can vouch for it from my personal experience and from having witnessed countless people heal themselves and their traumas over the last 30 years.
Yeah, it is a magical kind of practice, right? And it's very peculiar to try and understand it. But, you know, I would sort of just say, like, don't get lost in trying to understand why it works. You don't need to in order to reap the benefits of doing it, right? And it's also, it's a no-risk kind of exercise. It's not like someone's asking you to try this drug or something like that, where it might be crazy or something might go wrong or it could be a big problem. Like, breathing is just, it's absolutely fundamental to everyone's life, and everyone knows that, even if you don't think about it. And so to sort of suggest that someone just breathe a little bit differently for an hour, it's not like or even if it's 5 or 2 minutes, I mean, it doesn't even have to be an hour, right? One conscious breath can make a huge difference, right? And so this, while the science might not be there, as you said, the results are there, and they've been there for centuries or millennia, and they're available for anyone who's willing to try, right? So what would how would you recommend someone who sort of is, let's say, is just listening to this and has never done anything before? What's a good first step to do it?
Yeah, you know, there's so many of the breathing practices that are accessible online, and that's one of the beauty and the blessings of the times in which we live, that all that wisdom that you were referencing earlier, that we have spent millennia looking for solutions and looking for the way out and looking for a way back to source and to reconnection and to freedom, it's available to anybody right now. We don't have to like leave our lives and go join a monastery or an ashram. All that wisdom, all that information is available to us. Now, applying it to our lives is a whole separate subject, right? That's why, you know, in the book and in this book, it's like I've designed it in a way that's very integratable into our lives, because we don't need any more information. We're an information overload. What we need is transformation. And so every chapter has practices that are designed to apply those teachings and those concepts to our lives so as to make transformation possible. So in terms of the more powerful, longer versions that we're talking about, of you know, the breathwork sessions, I would recommend doing the first 5 at least with a trained professional, because it is really powerful and it is really cathartic, and people will often, you know, have in order to heal certain aspects of our past, sometimes it feels like we're going through it again. So it's good. It's really good to have somebody there sitting with you, holding space for you, and somebody who's trained, who can hold the space for all that stuff to come up, because that's what needs to happen, right? Because we have suppressed it. And what used to be spiritual teaching, that everything is energy, now we know from physics that it's true, everything is energy, and energy cannot be destroyed. So just because we weren't able to deal with something, some trauma, or just because we weren't able to feel an emotion, because we've all been conditioned to suppress our emotions, and somewhere along the way, some brilliant person decided to make the emotions weakness, and decided that, especially for men, right, the little boys don't cry. But what we've learned now from quantum physics is that it's true. Everything is energy. Energy cannot be destroyed. So just because we suppress all that stuff, doesn't go away. And so after a lifetime of suppressing emotions, we walk around like just cauldrons of suppressed emotion. And then the next unfortunate person rubs us the wrong way, says something to us or does something the wrong way, and boom, volcanic eruption. And then we cause real harm to our relationships, sometimes irreparably. Or that energy has to come out one way or the other. So then if we don't find a way to express it, it starts seeping out and starts showing up in physical symptoms, cancer, heart attacks, ulcers. And so it's really important that we've got to get this. We've got to learn how to feel our emotions and how to communicate them courageously, responsibly, and compassionately. And I would even say gracefully. Gracefully meaning in a way that the other person can hear it. Because every time we say, you did this, or you always do that, the other ego that doesn't even know that it's an ego, all it can do is defend. And especially when we use words like you always or you never, they might be even looking in our eyes, but that little ego is going back in time, back in time, back in time, until that one time in 2003 where it didn't do that. And then it gets to be right. And technically it's right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I don't always do that. That's not true. And but then we get caught in the technicalities of the argument rather than going into the truth of it. So that's one of the beauties of breathwork, is that it bypasses the mind and all the protective mechanisms of the ego, and it goes into that where the trauma actually lives now, which is in the body, which is the reason that sometimes, I might even say most of the time, talk therapy doesn't get to it, because the trauma no longer lives in the mind. So no amount of talking and understanding what happened to us when we're 5 or 7 or 10, it's not going to be enough, because the trauma now lives in the body. So we need a practice that can access that trapped energy where it's now somaticized, where it lives in the body. And not to put therapy down, right? And I'm not putting therapy down whole, you know, like completely. In the right hands, with somebody who is connected and with clear goals and intentions for therapy, it can be really, really healing and supportive. And we all know that you can sit on somebody's couch for 10, 20, 30 years at a time rehashing the same old crap and nothing happens. Mm-hmm. Because again, that trauma now lives in the body. So it's a great combination to do them both. I have a therapist who will, when their clients get stuck and they're plateau in their therapy process, they'll send somebody to me to do a weekend retreat or to do breath work, because it rakes the muck, right? So the stuff that we haven't been willing or able to look at, we're able to look at it then. But sometimes it feels intense. And sometimes it's scary. And it's not current day fear, right? But it's just the fear of a young mind that didn't know any better and that suppressed that stuff. You know, the many times that we didn't allow ourselves to feel grief or to feel anger or to feel whatever it was that it was. And so that's why it's good to have a facilitator, somebody to travel this with you at least the first 5-10 times. Then you can be taught how to do it yourself.
No, absolutely. And I think that's an important, like, cautionary tale, you know, of if you've got years of suppressed emotion and fear and trauma, you don't want to just bring that up all at once if you're not ready for it,
right?
Or at least if there's not someone there who is ready for it, because, I mean, in all likelihood, you'll probably just panic and suppress it again, and then, you know, you haven't, or you'll re-traumatize yourself, as right, sort of they say. But I think that, like, I mean, it's so interesting how you can bypass the mind with the breath, right? And even on a sort of smaller scale, like for me, what's powerful about the breath, perhaps not in the healing sense of it, I mean, that's one aspect of it, but in a different aspect of it, it's like, if you're just aware of your breathing, right? So even if you're not even controlling it specifically, if you're truly aware, you can't be thinking at the same time, right? And so it's a tremendous tool to be able to just take that step back that you can use at any point, at any time. It doesn't matter where you are. You could be, you know, in a meeting, in a social gathering, by yourself, on the train, in an airplane. No matter where you are, we're always allowed to breathe. No one's going to be, you don't have to worry about being chargy for breathing or whatever. And so to just be able to take that step back and notice your breath, that'll snap you out of your sort of train of thinking, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a different breath work technique, of course, to what you've been saying. But, I mean, for me, that's just it's another really big one, right, on top of the sort of long extended breathwork sessions, which are good, but also I suppose, like, you got to be ready for it.
Right, yeah. The breath is at the core of every single meditation practice. It's at the core of yoga. It's all about the breath, really. Mm-hmm. Like, the breath is our most faithful, our most loyal companion. So what you're talking about is, it's in meditation practices, the breath is one of the ways that, just by simply, like you're saying, focusing on our breath, on our inhale, on our exhale, it allows us to become present and to get disentangled from the mindfuck of the ego mind.
Yeah.
And so we begin to realize it's like, yeah, here I am. You know, call it the witness, call it the observer. There's so many terms that are used. The conscious part of us, the stadium part of us, who is having, so we can notice ourselves having thoughts and yet not jump on the bandwagon of the thought, right? Like, oh, there it is, having that thought, and like we let it come in and we let it go right back out. Like we retain choice over our thoughts, and we can even retain choice of our emotions. So not suppressing them, because we now know that doesn't work. But to realize that the emotion just energies coursing through our body, and we think of it like a 2-year-old, you know, having a total meltdown, a total tantrum. 2 minutes later, they're playing like if nothing happened. They had their emotion fully, and then they moved on to the next emotion. We get into trouble with them because we stuff them, we suppress them, and then they get stuck in our bodies. And after a lifetime of suppressing anger, we walk around like rage-filled volcanoes. After a lifetime of suppressing grief, you end up with, you know, that grief congeals and it freezes into depression. And it's because we didn't allow ourselves to feel it. So yeah, of course, we're not going to go around through life like just having a tantrum and dumping our emotions on each other, which is what we end up doing. And that's why our relationships most of the time end up not working. But to learn what we're feeling, to own that they're our emotions, because nobody can make us feel anything, and to learn how to communicate them courageously, responsibly, compassionately, it's nothing less than mastery level stuff, nothing less than heroism. Mm-hmm. So it's the opposite of weakness.
Yeah, absolutely. And we definitely do live in a very strange culture that has a very mixed relationship towards emotions. As you had said earlier, you know, sort of kids, particularly like little boys, are told that like crying is a weakness, or I mean, it's not even just boys. It's like if girls cry too much, it's seen as a weakness as well. I mean, it's everyone, right? Or that you shouldn't be angry, or that you shouldn't be this, or shouldn't be that, or whatever it is. It's not a good way of doing things. Particularly, I mean, it's hard to even imagine how that came to be, because I guess my guess would be that it was out of fear that it sort of happened, right? Because it's such a natural part of just human beings. Like, everyone is emotional to some degree or other, right? It's a natural way of interacting with the world. It tells you about certain situations. And I really liked what you said, that perhaps you could elaborate on a bit more about how no one can make you feel anything, right?
Yeah. You know, our emotions are ours. So say that you and I have a weekly lunch with Joe, and Joe is inevitably 20 minutes late. And so I have lunch with Joe on Mondays, and there I am. It's like, I knew it. I knew he was going to be late. He's so selfish. He is so self-absorbed. He doesn't care about anybody but his own schedule. He doesn't care about mine. And then we adding layers and layers and layers of meaning and judging Joe for being late. And this is not about excusing Joe's lateness. That's a whole other conversation.
Yeah.
But whereas you, on Tuesdays, on your weekly Tuesday lunch with Joe, it's like, great, 20 minutes. Thank you. I can go online and catch up in the news. I can return that phone call. I can check my email, right? There's so many possible reactions or responses to Joe's lateness. Mm-hmm. So why is it that it gets me so upset? And again, not to excuse the lateness, but why does it bug me so much? And so that's the part of the heroic journey, that if we're willing to do that work and ask ourselves those questions, and to own our experience and to own our emotions, we're able to heal those things, because it might look something like this. You know, it's we get really honest and we start asking ourselves, why does it bug me so much? It's not just about Joe. It's when anybody's late, it gets my goat. And if we start zooming out even further, it's not just when they're late. It's when anybody cuts me off in conversation, when anybody cuts me off in traffic, that gets me going. It's kind of a very similar feeling. So let me get clear about it, because all the stuff is subconscious. Let's get really clear. What am I feeling? right? It's underneath that anger about lateness. What am I feeling, right? I'm feeling disrespected. I'm feeling not valued. I'm feeling not seen. I'm feeling that I'm not giving my worth, that I'm not being loved, right? So if I get that honest with myself, those feelings are way older than even the time that I've known Joe and certainly have been having lunch with him.
Yeah.
But once, and if we trace it back, it's probably going to go back to something that happened in childhood, probably in response to our parents. And in our willingness and our courage to be able to look at our reactions that way, it makes possible the healing, because it all stemmed from that misunderstanding of a young mind that interpreted something and decided that I'm not worthy of love, or that I'm not good enough, or that there's something wrong with me, or that I'm too much of this, not enough of that. Whatever it is, in our case, which is going to be somewhere in that constellation of feelings about ourselves, and none of it true. They're just misunderstandings again. Something that we misheard. Our parents got divorced, and you know, we like took it personally. It's like, oh my God, how could Daddy leave me? Doesn't Daddy love me? And if he doesn't love me, what's wrong with me? Right? Had nothing to do with us. Like we don't stop. We don't have the ability then to understand like what was going on in Daddy's mind, what was going on in their relationship. We don't understand their patterns of their relationship, how they were raised, how their parents before them were raised. We don't know about their brain biochemistry, any substance abuse issues that were impacting their relationship. We took it on as our fault. It had nothing to do with us. And so in our willingness to, it's like, oh my God, like this had nothing to do with Joe being late. But now that I see that this is my unhealed button that misunderstood and thought that there was something wrong with me, or that I'm not good enough or not worthy, it's like now I can do something about it. I can go to a therapy session. I can go to a breathwork session. I can go to whatever I need to do to heal that, so that anybody shows up late in the world and it doesn't evoke that in us.
Yeah. No, it's true. And it all comes down to that perception of self. Right, and that self-judgment, and how it's true as kids, like you internalize everything, right? It's even in psychology literature, it's well established that kids will take things on because it makes more sense to attribute blame to yourself than to find fault in your caregivers or whatever it is. And it's just trying to make sense of the world, right? And so it's not even that when that happens to you that now, or you know, let's say you've noticed that you've got all these like trigger points or whatever it is, and that, you know, there's a sort of like a word of caution to not fall back into judging yourself again for that same thing and being caught in the same trap, just from a different angle, because now you could come in from the side and be like, oh, well, I shouldn't be feeling triggered, and why did this happen to me? And then you're just stuck in the same loop again, right? And then that's not going to help you either. But it's that being able to come back to that sense of like, okay, well, it happened this way. That's okay. There's nothing I can do about it happening. What I do have a choice is now, how do I respond to it in this moment? Yes. Right,
yeah.
Where that's where things can change, and in every moment, that's where it can change. And you might have to do it 100 times a day, like that, to, because you're trying to rewire your brain, essentially. If you want to look at it from a sort of neurobiological perspective, it's like learning how to do and be different in the world takes time, right? And that's not important. What's important is to just be able to, at each point, just be like, okay, this is how it is. It's okay. How am I going to be now? And what am I going to do now? Right. And that's the hero who can take that approach. Right.
Yeah. You just, you know, like expressed it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Things are going to happen that suck and that we wish they hadn't happened, and that shouldn't happen to any kid or to any of us. And, all right, it happened. And shit's going to happen.
Yeah.
We always have a choice, is how we respond to that event. And that alone, if we get nothing else but that out of this conversation, that is a game changer. And that that steps us back into our own power, because we can always choose that response. And nobody embodies that better for me, or exemplifies that better for me, than Viktor Frankl, the Austrian psychiatrist, mm-hmm. whom I was able to, you know, I feel really fortunate that I was able to hear him speak before he died.
Oh, cool.
And, you know, he lost everything, you know, spent years in concentration camps. Everything was taken away from him. His property, his degrees, his family, lost everything. And you know, his pregnant wife, everybody taken away from him. And choice, every little choice taken away from him. Like, we can't ever imagine what it's like to be in a concentration camp, no matter how many books or we read or movies we watch, because we take so many little choice points every single day for granted. You know, am I going to have breakfast? Or am I going to skip breakfast? Am I going to wake up at 6:30? Or am I going to snooze another 15 minutes? Am I going to wear my red shirt or my blue shirt? And not to mention the big choices about our relationships, about what we do with our lives. Like, everything, every little choice was taken away from him. And that guy was able to say that they could take everything away from him except for one thing, the ability to choose how he would be in response to that. So, not to minimize anybody's trauma or anybody's pain. We all have had that, that pain in our lives. But if he can do it in a concentration camp, certainly we can do that in our lives. And that alone reclaims, is a way that we can start reclaiming our power.
Yeah. That book, Man's Search for Meaning, is, it's unbelievable. I mean, it's hard, you know, when you read it, like, it's hard to imagine that a lot of that stuff is happening to that guy, right? Because you're like, how does someone respond like this in these conditions? And what's amazing about his story is also that, you know, he not only managed to survive, right? And part of which he sort of explains is that, like, well, the reason he was able to survive was because he chose to not let circumstances take that from him, right? And again, it's that choice. And through that, I mean, he became one of the world's most influential people to some degree or other, right? Like, in certain spheres, I suppose. But changed countless people's lives for the better, right? Because he lived that experience and he came out the other side and he was able to say, I've done it in hell, right?
Yeah.
And if I can do it in hell and I'm just a regular guy, you can do it in your life too, right?
Yeah.
And it's a tremendous message. And it aligns exactly with your message, right? Which is just, this is possible. There's another way of living. There's another way of being. And anyone can do it. And all you need is just to do it in this moment, right? You don't need to come up with some master plan of how to re-transform every aspect of everything and every part of you. Like, it'll happen, right? But it's that just now, just be like, okay, take a breath. How am I going to respond to this moment? And then move forwards. And I think it's wonderful. Yeah. But listen, Christian, I've really enjoyed this conversation with you. And I thank you very much for coming on the podcast today. Would you like to promote and plug your book and where people can find you and, you know, your retreats and stuff?
Yeah. Thank you, Shane. And we hardly even touched upon how we step into personal power in a way that's not about hierarchy and control and fear and force and domination.
We'll do that in a different way sometime.
Yeah, you and I could definitely keep on talking.
Yeah.
So thank you. Thank you for the invitation and thank you for your work and the type of conversations that you're fostering, because they really do make a difference in so many lives. So thank you for that. And thanks for having me on the show. In terms of how to reach me, the book is available wherever books are sold. So Amazon or your local bookstore. And in terms of reaching me, probably the best way is my website, soulfulpower.com. From there, they can access social media. And for anybody listening who signs up to be on my email list, they will get a sample chapter that talks about part of what we've been talking about, the living heroically, what it means to live heroically in the 21st century. They'll get some of the power practices that we spoke about earlier. And they'll get a guided meditation and teachings about trust, and what that means and how we moved closer to that, which I think it's so supportive in these times of chaos and uncertainty. So thank you again, and thanks for doing all you do.
Fantastic. And I'll put all those links in the description for anyone who's interested, which I would highly recommend, by the way. But again, thanks, Christian. We'll talk again soon. We'll be right back.